Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of debate, dialogue, healthcare, and science in the news, discussions, and answers to your questions via email and phone calls. But before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for professional consultation. Well, I geeked out a little bit on you last week. That has to do with the fact that I was off at a conference, so we'll be dealing with some follow-up emails about autophagy, but I wanted to just share with you some of the very interesting information. The conference was all about bioidentical hormone replacement therapy, and then lo and behold, at the top of my story stack this morning, hormone replacement therapy is in fact making a comeback. The story from Science Daily, survey of pharmacists shows a massive growth in compounded menopausal hormone therapy. This was a survey of about 500 pharmacists, and what it showed was really astonishing. The number of prescriptions for bioidentical hormone therapy has expanded enormously. Pharmacists expect a 25% growth of hormone therapy compounding by 2016. The proportion of prescriptions written, basically nationwide, there are 36 million total prescriptions for compounded hormone replacement therapy filled last year. It's getting up to be close to 30% of the prescriptions written across the board, because there were not, there were 36. Basically, we are looking at about 60,000. I'm trembling all over myself here. We're looking at 60 million hormone replacement therapies prescriptions annually, and from that number, half of them are compounded. That's really, really astonishing. And compounded prescriptions are, in my opinion, safer, and I can back that up. But there's a quote here in this article that I wanted to throw out. According to the Endocrine Society, there is no scientific evidence supporting the safety or effectiveness of compounded bioidentical hormones. Now, obviously, the Endocrine Society was reading a press release ghostwritten for them by Big Pharma. So just to counteract that, on my website right now at AskDrDawn.com in the links, which is called the resources page, you will find an article with over 76 references documenting safety and effectiveness of compounded hormone therapy. So there may not be any literature, scientific literature, in the handouts that you're getting from your pharmaceutical reps, Endocrine Society, but there sure is an awful lot if you do a Google search. Our next story is, you know how I love the microbiome. This is a article coming out of the endocrine meeting, the Society of Endocrinology in San Diego. A study of black males who are pre-diabetic done by the VA, these 116 African-American male veterans aged 45 to 75. This is called the DIVA study, vitamin D intervention study. And what they are doing is they are taking a look at whether or not I'm not sure what dose of vitamin D they're actually using, will prevent or reduce the chance of progressing from pre-diabetes to diabetes. There is actually research to suggest that that's the case. But they're also studying the gut flora. And in these groups, they identified men who were pre-diabetic, and then those who had more beneficial bacteria were less likely to progress to actual diabetes. So a stool sample could actually have prognostic value. That's news enough. And it's certainly suggestive that if we shift the gut flora in the direction of those non-progressing diabetics, that maybe we could show success with them, with the ones who would have otherwise progressed. So fixing the bowel flora isn't proven yet, but certainly it it works in inflammatory bowel disease, maybe it's going to work in diabetes, which is, of course, the most common inflammatory condition out there. And, of course, from my standpoint as someone who actively has a medical practice, I'm looking at the bowel flora thought now and thinking, maybe I could track patient compliance because, you know, surveys show that people lie to their doctors. Who'd have thunk it? But anyway, if you lie to your doctor and your doctor gets a stool smear, maybe they could figure out just from your bowel flora that you really are chowing down on processed food. And in a related story, and this was sent to me by two people who are regular listeners, thanks to Tim in Nebraska and Doug in Santa Cruz for bringing this to my attention, because I actually did not have that on my radar for today. And this is basically an article published in the most recent issue of Nature, and it's about dietary emulsifiers. It suggests that it may not just be the starch and the sugar in processed food. This is a little bit spooky, actually, for those of us who like healthy convenience food. The common emulsifiers, namely carboxymethylcellulose and polysorbate 80, cause low-grade inflammation, and in a mouse model, actually induced a metabolic syndrome, in other words, a pre-diabetes in mice. And this is really spooky, because when we go out there and we go to the health food store and we buy ourselves a cereal, let's say, that's supposed to be made with all whole grains and la la la, and it's supposed to be organic and GMO free and all the good stuff, right? Except it's got emulsifiers in there, because that's what you need to change the compounding of the food into something that'll have a shelf life, that'll sit there, that won't separate. So that healthy roasted pepper spread with emulsifiers in it may actually melt the protective mucus in your intestine and allow bacteria that are present in your intestine to irritate the lining of the wall. That irritation leads to inflammation. That inflammation causes gut permeability, leads to food sensitivity. These emulsifiers came into use widely in around the 1950s, 1960s, as processed food really got a foothold in America. Before that, we cooked. I know, so retro. But in any event, now that we are not cooking and we are even buying convenience health food, it's possible that that emulsifiers, which are very common, may injure the gut. And so, folks, if you want to be healthy, you really need to start cooking. You need to learn to cook. And if you don't know, there are lots of classes and there's lots of YouTube videos. But I think the healthiest thing you can possibly do is buy fresh, ideally buying local, and cook it yourself rather than using convenience foods. Until we know more, we have to use the precautionary principle here. So, oh well, so much for, look for emulsifiers and watch out for them, because they may be soaping up your gut a little too much. This one from David and Salinas, subject the glymphatic system. This was something I talked about last week on the pre-recorded show, and David Sirkin, MD, PhD, writes, I didn't hear Dr. Dawn mention anything about sleep in relation to the functions of the glymphatic system. I thought she might be interested to learn this additional piece of information. I attended the Society for Neuroscience meeting in Washington this past November, and I heard a lecture by M. Niedergaard, the discoverer of the glymphatic system. She told us that the system only does its cleanup work significantly during sleep. So only during sleep do the extracellular spaces expand enough for the fluid movement to occur. This may, in fact, be a major function of sleep. And I'm sure we've all experienced enough sleep deprivation to know that if you don't sleep well for a few days, your brain gets messed up and it doesn't work as fast. It may literally be because your neurons are getting clogged with debris, with the breakdown products of normal physiologic functioning, and the trash men are on strike because the trash men only work at night. Now, isn't that interesting? We already know from alternative medicine that detoxification and essentially getting rid of the garbage that's a normal part of existence is done at night. So sleep is so fundamental. And in fact, whenever I'm dealing with someone who complains of fatigue and tiredness or brain fog, the first place you go isn't heavy metals. It isn't diet. It isn't even inflammation. It's sleep. Because if the sleep ain't happy, ain't nobody happy. This from Sherry in Santa Cruz. First of all, I want to thank you for your brilliant program. You have an amazing ability to describe very complex biochemical processes using clear metaphors and analogies. And I love the fact that you don't dumb down anything and are willing to air your opinions and knowledge on so many subjects. You're a community treasure. Thank you, Sherry. Now for my question. I wonder if you might help us unpack recently reported research in JAMA that links anticholinergic drugs to dementia, including several over-the-counter antihistamines used for seasonal and other allergies. I'm particularly concerned to read that diphenhydramine, the only antihistamine I've been able to find without dyes, is the culprit at a very low average daily dose of 4 milligrams. Since the over-the-counter package dose is 25 milligrams for only 4 hours, doesn't this mean that anyone taking 4 daily doses for allergies for 3 weeks annually would fall into the zone of a 54% increase in risk for dementia? And the same for someone taking 25 a couple of nights per week for insomnia. With 18.5% of research subjects diagnosed with Alzheimer's and another 4.5% with other forms of dementia, what does that 54 increase for dementia mean? It sounds like a huge 1 in 8 chance to me of getting dementia from a good night's sleep. And you'd think that would result in pulling this medicine off over-the-counter status, which leads me to think there must be something wrong with my understanding or the reporting of this issue or the research design. Just say it isn't so. I'd also like your thoughts on second-generation antihistamines. Do Claritin and Zyrtec work by different mechanisms? So here's a number of links that Sherry sent me. Thank you. I love it when people ask me about stories and then send me links to the stories. That saves so much time. The story appeared in JAMA Internal Medicine, and it was entitled Cumulative Use of Strong Anticholinergics and Incipient Dementia. This was a research done in Seattle. Group Health Cooperative is one of the largest and longest standing HMOs, and Seattle has always had a fairly enlightened Washington in general has had an enlightened kind of HMO practice, sort of like the Kaiser Permanente system that we have here in California, pretty much run by doctors. Doctors in suits is much better than business majors in suits running your health corporation. Let me just tell you that business majors totally get this thing that you're supposed to make, that your duty is to your stockholders. And doctors are conflicted about that because they have this thing called the Hippocratic Oath, which says first you don't do any harm and then you worry about making money, which if we made everybody who ran health companies take that oath, we'd have a really different universe. More about that Wendell Potter interview that I'm trying to put together later. Back to our story. This is kind of scary, and let me give you the background. So they've got 3,000 people with no dementia, 65 or older, at the beginning of the study. So in the mid-1990s, they recruit people. Then they monitor them for about 10 years. They've now got 20-year data on this group. So the ones that developed dementia, so let's talk about that. You've got 3,400 people above 65. 800 of them developed dementia over the time of the study. And about 70-80% of these develop Alzheimer's disease. So then they go back and they look at antihistamine use and other anticholinergic drugs as well. So they looked at tricyclic antidepressants. They looked at bladder drugs because, by the way, a lot of those drugs that are advertised to help you with your bladder urgency are anticholinergics. Those of you who have smoked marijuana or otherwise consumed it may have noticed an anticholinergic effect, which is that it's hard to pee. And this is because of the fact that peeing uses acetylcholine to fire off the muscle, this big hollow muscle called the bladder. If you block acetylcholine, then you block the squeezing that empties out your bladder. And particularly if you've got a large prostate, you're very aware that antihistamines do this as well. Yes, acetylcholine also does other things. Besides making your bladder contract, acetylcholine is the neurotransmitter of memory. So it's not too surprising that if you give the anti-neurotransmitter of memory drug, that you're going to have memory problems. And the key here is that these are long-term studies. And this does suggest that routine use of these, and they standardized doses, and basically if you were taking more than 1,000 doses of antihistamine over 10 years, that was the group that had a 1.54 in risk ratio. So that means if the average person in that 3,000 group, their risk of getting dementia was, we know what it was because it was 3,500 divided by 800. So there's your risk of dementia. Multiply that by 1.5 for the high users of acetylcholine inhibitors. So high users of antihistamines. This is very spooky. The mechanism is not confirmed. This is an association study. We know that it impairs functioning, particularly if you have dementia, but this is suggesting that it actually impairs it long term, and that even though you haven't used it for a while, the people who were tested here were taken off antihistamines when they developed their dementia, and their dementia didn't get better. So what's going on here? Could it be related to affecting these cells in some fundamental way? Could the fact that you are blocking acetylcholine have feedback effects on the trophic influences that make nerve cells grow? I think that's probably going to be the mechanism. This is just me blue skying on it. I don't have data, but I understand enough about how the neurotransmitters work to know that everything feeds back on everything else. And so one of the things that may be happening here is that if the acetylcholine can't be received because it's being dropped, either in terms of blocking at the receptor level or because it's not being produced, either way, that may be a growth signal to the neuron. Every time you think a thought, that neuron goes, oh, I got thunk. I guess I'm going to keep growing and stay healthy. Whereas the neurons you don't use that don't receive trophic influence kind of get sludgy, and maybe they fill up with debris and they don't get cleaned out and eventually become inflamed and the immune system takes them down. Oops. Well, anyway, more later about this, but I'm thinking that I'm going to discourage the use of antihistamines, particularly for sleep. And believe me, most of the over-the-counter prescriptions for sleep are antihistamines. So until further notice, I'm recommending yellow. You know, there's red, there's green, red, and yellow signals on things. This is a proceed with caution, try to find something else. Magnesium, chamomile tea, tryptophan, valerian. There's lots of other options. They just aren't at your local pharmacy. You actually have to go hunt for them. But the nice person at the local health food store in the tea section will give you some guidance. One last thing on this anticholinergic effect. The antihistamines, the second generations, are larger molecules. So Claritin, Zyrtec, and Allegra, which would be loratadine, fexofenadine. That's Allegra. So loratadine and fexofenadine, generic, probably less dangerous because it's a bigger molecule. So it does, while it has that effect on the bladder, it doesn't get into the brain in as high a quantity. That being said, I'm still going to proceed with caution and get out your neti pot if you're, because we are heading into the spring allergy season. Our first caller is Carrie in Aptos. And Carrie, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Dr. Dunn. I have been trying to, wanting to ask you to talk about the connection between inflammation and stress. I'm a senior, I'm somewhat overweight, and I've had a really high stress level for years and years. And I'm just wondering, what is the connection between stress and inflammation and stress, or vice versa?
Well, I think we're still exploring the mechanisms. One obvious mechanism, however, is the feedback loop between cortisol, which is effectively the hormone mm-hmm. of stress. Both mm-hmm. adrenaline and cortisol will cause your body to, essentially become insulin resistant. And your body compensates for the, and you're overweight, so you have from the fat that's in your belly, if you have, to the extent that your fat is located in your midsection, it makes you insulin resistant also. And that's kind of this weird thing, but I've started to think of belly fat as a gland, you know, an independent gland. It's kind of like a cancer in that it's got a mind of its own and it doesn't really care about its host, and it just wants to grow. So belly fat excretes 17 different hormones, 16 of which are bad, and they have a whole lot of bad effects, like they make your blood thicker so you're more likely to clot, and it's directly pro-inflammatory cytokines. It actually secretes inflammatory compounds that turn on the immune system. How about that? Anyway, cortisol also does this, and so your stress, which is lots of adrenaline spikes and a high level of cortisol, that is going to also make you more insulin resistant. Insulin is directly pro-inflammatory. And so in a nutshell, that's a piece of it. The other piece of it is the gut, and that's the part where I say the mechanisms have not been fully elicited, but if the heavier you are, the more likely you are to have inflammatory gut flora. And we know that that shifts if you turn down your grain consumption. So I'm getting on kind of a rant on grain, and I don't really mean to, but you have to eat grain in a way that it doesn't raise your insulin levels. And it has to be whole grain. That means not flour. So whole grain bread, it doesn't count as a whole grain. If you want to eat kashi or wheat berries or something like that, that's probably fine in moderation, because it's going to take a long time to digest, so it won't raise your insulin levels. And it comes along with the fiber, which supports the good bacteria, so you probably don't end up with adverse gut flora when you're eating whole grain the way you do when you're eating processed food. And processed food even means, like, back to 1,000 years ago when the Egyptians were grinding bread, were grinding wheat, you know, between two rocks and then making bread with it. That's still processed. And that's the thing you have to get through your head. It can be primitively processed, and it's still probably bad for your intestinal flora.
Okay, so what can I do to keep the inflammation down in, overall in my system?
Well, the first step for you, it sounds like, is exercise and meditation or some form of relaxation. When I have a patient like you come to my office, one of the things I do is I take a toxic exposure history, and that maybe includes your boss and or your spouse or a child who has special needs. And if you frame these influences as toxins and you understand that there's such a thing as psychological poisoning and it has distinct physiological consequences, just like if someone was putting cyanide in your tea, if someone is putting acid in your brain because they're snarking at you all the time, that is erosive and damaging to your physiology. So, you know, try to get away from toxins, including toxic relationships. To the extent that you have to be in toxic relationships, you're going to have to armor yourself and also purge yourself of the toxins. That means detoxifying with exercise, detoxifying with stress reduction, guided imagery. There's tons of things on the web that you can download and listen to on headphones that will walk you through a relaxation 15 minutes that will bring down those stress hormones. And it works. And if you do this when you're not stressed, and you start after a couple of, like when you're falling asleep, or if that's a time when you're not stressed, but if you can do it when you're not stressed, then your rat brain down there, your subconscious, associates the lack of stress of it with the visualization. And then when you do the visualization when you're stressed, your rat brain goes, we're supposed to be not stressed now, and it shifts your physiology in that direction. So it becomes it's a tool, and you can train that rat brain to be your friend rather than your enemy. So
okay, so
exercise and work the rat.
Okay, thank you for your show.
We don't have. You're welcome. Bye bye. We're now going back to the phones to talk to some listeners with questions. This to Susan in Aptos. Hello, Susan.
Thank you, Dr. Don, and I would like to know what you think about BGL licorice for a peptic ulcer versus omeprazole Is that how you say it?
Yes, and thank you. That's a wonderful question. I could talk about that for a long time, but I won't. I'll be succinct. So DGL is, and I always get the, I always say this wrong, but it's, I'm going to do my best, glycyrrhizic acid, and it is a compound that raises blood pressure. So they take it out for DGL. So that's all that DGL is. It's the licorice plant with one of its compounds removed. By the way, that compound is also a very good adrenal support agent, but you have to be careful with blood pressure, and you will see warnings about it. I have once in my life had a patient have a problem with potassium from taking four or five different products that all contained pure licorice. So you can't overdose on it. You can't really overdose on DGL. And one of its properties is that it coats the lining of mucosa. So it coats the lining of the esophagus and coats the lining of the mucus. And we had a story earlier today, I hope you caught it, about how emulsifiers mess up this mucus layer and how emulsifiers in processed food could create a leaky gut and possibly contribute to gut inflammation and metabolic syndrome. So by extension, DGL might actually help prevent those things, but it's primarily used for people with peptic disease. Now, omeprazole, that's used to be called Prilosec. It used to be a prescription. When it first came out, we were a little worried about it because it causes stomach tumors in dogs. And we're like, I wonder if it's going to cause stomach tumors in people. It turns out it hasn't, but it does cause a certain cell in the stomach to overgrow. These are called parietal cells. And these contribute to acid. So essentially, if you block all the acid, kind of like that acetylcholine feedback loop in the brain, if you block all of the acid, then the acid-producing cells grow because they're like, hey, there's no acid. There need to be more of us. And you will actually generate essentially a physical addiction to proton pump inhibitors if you take omeprazole for years, because you will grow more acid-secreting cells that you will then need to suppress with the drug, it's sort of like cigarettes, really. You get to the point where you're physiologically dependent on alcohol, and you get physiologically dependent on cigarettes, and you get physiologically dependent on proton pump inhibitors. And funny, these are all made by large U.S. corporations. But anyway, back to DGL. It probably isn't enough alone. It's certainly not as powerful as a proton pump inhibitor. And I'll often use proton pump inhibitors for short periods of time, say 8 weeks, the only exception being people who have precancerous esophaguses. And if you've got precancerous Barrett's esophagus, then the risk of cancer trumps the risk of the proton pump inhibitor. Although, by the way, Barrett's is reversible. I have seen it reverse, but it takes a comprehensive program of DGL and lots of it, usually relatively high doses of actual stomach acid, and you give that with the meals, and then between the meals, you suppress the acid with a proton pump inhibitor. You get the ulcer healed. Then you change to a partial proton pump inhibitor, which isn't a partial blocker of acid, called an H2 and blocker. And these type 2 histamine blockers are about 50% of your acid is gone. And then you taper that over time if you can. But in the long run, if a person's actually had an ulcer, they have to be checked for H. pylori. They have to stop taking non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs and never take them again, because you've got to figure out why that person got the ulcer, and those are the two big reasons.
Well, I got the ulcer because I was taking over-the-counter aspirin and not, in enteric-coated aspirin, and I was dehydrated, and I had just, had surgery from a hip fracture. And
so you probably, yeah, okay.
That's the reason that I got the ulcer, and now I am on 20 milligrams of the omeprazole, and by the time I finish this first prescription, I will be taking it for a month, and I was hoping, because one of the side effects that I have read about on the omeprazole is it can cause a hip fracture. Well, I already have that.
Oh, well, yes, but that's with like 10 years of use. It's a long-term problem, because you need acid to absorb calcium. That's the quick reason. So I don't encourage long-term use of this. You're not going to break your hip with a couple of months, and you need to get that ulcer healed. But if you go to my website, askdrdawn.com, in the resources page, there is a handout for getting off proton pump inhibitors. It's just an advice for how someone can taper down. And once you remove, in your case, you've removed the instigator, and you need to always avoid non-steroidals. Once this happens to you, you really shouldn't take aspirin, ibuprofen, even celecoxib, which is the one that supposedly doesn't cause ulcers. It actually does if you take it for more than 6 months. So you really need to find other forms of pain relief. And hopefully now that you, hopefully you will. But
I'm taking Tylenol for pain.
Good. All right. So any last questions?
Nope, that's it.
All right. Well, good luck to you, and I hope I've helped.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Going now to Gail in Pacific Grove. Hello, Gail.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I tore my rotator cuff 2 weeks ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And I had an x-ray, and I saw an orthopedic surgeon, and I just wanted to discuss how they generally go with you. You know, she said a surgery obviously is an option, and I'm over 70, so I don't think physical therapy is going to be the best choice for me. She wanted me to try 10 visits with physical therapy to see if it would heal, but it doesn't sound too inviting to me. I just wanted to get your feedback on that.
Well, first of all, I think your orthopedist is a keeper.
Good.
Because she didn't say, oh, you must have surgery. And
not at all, no.
No, that's really good.
I think so, too.
So that's a keeper.
Okay.
And it does heal without surgery a lot of the time. At 70...
It's getting better. It's less painful.
Right. The thing that I most worry about, of course, it is going to heal, but it's going to take time, and while it's healing, you need some guidance to avoid a complication called adhesive capsulitis. Now, adhesive capsulitis sounds like things sticking together, and I used to think that was what it was, but since I've been doing, since I got my acupuncture skills and started doing acupuncture on quote-unquote frozen shoulders, I've discovered that, in fact, they're not adhered such that they can't be fixed. The thing is, so you need to keep it moving, and there are a couple of things, pendulum exercises, and I call it the itsy bitsy spider. You remember that that nursery rhyme, and you literally use your fingers to walk your arm up the wall and sidle up to the wall until your armpit is pressed against the wall straight up. You can do that on your good side. You might not be able to do that on your rotator cuff side right now, but the point is that passive motion, keeping that that humerus moving in the socket, prevents a set of reflexes from forming that tighten all the muscles, and effectively then you have a tight muscle, so it hurts when you move the shoulder, so you don't move the shoulder, and before you know it, your shoulder's glued to your side, and you've got about 10 degrees of, you've got just enough room to get your underarm deodorant in there, and that lasts for months. So you need the physical therapy.
I don't want to do that.
You need the physical therapy, okay? At least
I will do it.
A couple of sessions.
Thank you so much.
If you're a responsible, intelligent person, you can go to 2 sessions of physical therapy, and you don't have to go anymore. You just have to do the exercises. And the key is, the first time they teach you the exercises, and then you do them, and then you go back about 5 days later, and you demonstrate them, and they tell you how you've managed to distort what they told you and do it wrong, and you let them fix your form.
Right.
Okay. And then you keep doing them, and you have to keep doing them for 3 months. At least before you're going to be fully recovered,
and it will eventually likely not need surgery if all this goes well.
Likely not need surgery if all goes well. I couldn't have said it better myself.
Oh well, thank you, doctor.
You're very welcome. Bye bye.
Okay, bye bye.
Now I have an important story here. This is going out to all of the people who have had breast cancer. It's a study, a long-term study, looking at the recurrence rate. This is a second cancer in the opposite breast, so it's called a contralateral breast cancer. We know that it's not just a piece of cancer that was left behind. It's actually new, and about 10% of breast cancer survivors will develop a second distinct cancer. if you were a breast cancer, are a breast cancer survivor, you probably want to know, what can I do to lower my odds of getting that cancer? And that's what this story is about. First of all, you can lose weight. If you have a body mass index of more than 30 kilograms per meter squared, in other words, if you're in the obese range, there's a 1.5 increased risk. So again, we were talking about a 1.5 increased risk of Alzheimer's in the group that got Alzheimer's, there was more use of the antihistamines. In the group that gets a second breast cancer, they're heavier. And that's something, at least to a certain extent, under the control. You can also exercise. That helps you lose weight. But the weight itself is probably the issue. Consuming at least 7 alcoholic drinks per week after the first breast cancer diagnosis gives you a 1.9-fold risk. In other words, a drink a day almost doubles your long-term risk of a second breast cancer. So you shouldn't drink. I mean, it's just not worth it. The third thing is smoking. Smoking doubles your risk, 2.2 increased risk. So you can lose weight, quit smoking, and stop drinking. And if you stop drinking, you'll probably lose weight. So there's a twofer there. But here's the real take home. And this is big news, folks. If you know anybody who's a breast cancer survivor who smokes and drinks 7 drinks a week, that group had a 700% increased risk. In other words, 7-fold, 7 times more recurrent breast cancer if you smoke and drink. And pharma, not all big pharma is bad. By the way, diabetics who were diagnosed with diabetes before the age of 54 and had breast cancer had a 600% increased risk of a recurrent breast cancer. But if the diabetics were diagnosed after 55, in other words, postmenopausally, it was a postmenopausal cancer, that only doubled the risk. But back to big pharma, use of bisphosphonates for 6 months or longer actually reduced the risk of developing a second breast cancer. Let me say that again. These drugs that are for osteoporosis, for some reason, reduced breast cancer, and we don't know the mechanism, but the risk reduction was 0.79, so that means that it dropped your risk quite substantially to be on a bisphosphonate. So we got to be fair and balanced in our coverage here, and this is important. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.